I'm David Marcus, host of Drinks with the Deal, and today our guest is Neil Barr, the chair and managing partner of Davis Polk & Wardwell. Our conversation with Neil is the first in a four-podcast mini-series with law firm leaders. Neil, thank you so much for joining us today.
David, thank you very much for having me.
So we're going to talk about your background on today's podcast, how you came to the law, how you came to become a law firm manager and ultimately the chair of Davis Polk, the issues that you're focused on now in running the firm, and a little bit about how you decompress from the job. So with that, tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, how you came to practice law.
Sure. So I grew up in a town called Virginia Beach, Virginia. My mother was a pharmacist and my father was a jeweler. And through my high school life, I never really had traveled very much. And certainly coming to New York City was way outside of anything that I had ever contemplated at that time. After high school, I attended the University of Virginia, a university for which I have still a tremendous amount of love and affection. And it was an exceptional experience for me. At UVA, I majored in what they call commerce. It's a business school degree. I'm a Bachelor of Science in Finance. But I ultimately concluded at the end of my time at University of Virginia that I wanted to go to law school. I had always been told by my parents that it was important to have a profession that could not be taken away from you, one that you could always hang a shingle around. So my mother had always talked about being a doctor or a lawyer as something that would be that type of profession. And against that backdrop, I concluded ultimately that law school was what I wanted to do, something that folks generally don't do in today's world and something I don't advise as to, but immediately after college, I enrolled at Georgetown University Law Center. You know, I still had a mid-Atlantic part of the United States orientation when I enrolled in law school. My first summer after law school, I interned as a 1L summer associate at a law firm called Kaufman & Knowles in Norfolk, Virginia. It was a sort of a large corporate law firm down there. And in my second summer, I was a summer associate at what was then called Hogan & Hartson in Washington, D.C. I liked Hogan & Hartson at that time. It was during the dot-com bubble. The Dulles Corridor was a very active technology, transactional part of the United States. And so for the Washington, D.C. area in the late 90s, Hogan & Hartson was one of the law firms that was really doing deals back then. However, during my first year of law school, first semester, I met the woman who became my wife. We were in the same section of law school, and she had worked in New York City before law school. And she very much wanted to return to the city after law school. And so we were engaged by the end of law school. And if you will, persuaded me that it would be best for us to relocate to New York City. Among other things, she thought what she was right about, and she's right about most things. She took the perspective that you can go to New York City and always leave to go elsewhere, but not necessarily the other way around. And so at that time, there was a robust 3L hiring environment. We interviewed as 3Ls. I ultimately concluded that the firm I wanted to join would be Davis Polk. She ended up going to Cahill. And that brought us at least to New York City and me to Davis Polk. It's interesting. At the time, I was still not entirely sure that this is what I wanted to do. And at the time, we were still in the middle of the dot-com boom or the dot-com burst. And I was so unsure about what I wanted to do that I actually started my career as a capital markets lawyer for 6 months because I took the perspective that if I really didn't like it, it would be easier to leave as a capital markets lawyer than the type of practice law that I really wanted to do, which was tax.
So how did you become interested in tax?
Yeah, it's interesting. In law school, I had this perspective that my undergraduate Bachelor of Science in Finance would resonate well in a tax practice, but it was certainly just an instinct. My second year of law school, I took individual income tax and corporate income tax with Marty Ginsburg. Marty was Ruth Bader Ginsburg's husband. He was one of the most esteemed tax practitioners of his and all generations. He's quite literally the person who wrote the book on M&A taxation. And I fell in love with it. I just absolutely fell in love with it as a discipline. I liked it because it was business, it was case law, it was regulatory, it was statutory. And so the depth of what you got in a tax practice and the cross-disciplinary nature of it was just tremendously appealing to me.
And as you said, he is a legendary figure in the tax bar, and he taught for many, many years at Georgetown. What was he like as a teacher?
He was just exceptional. He was truly an exceptional professor, a kind man. He had this amazingly dry but deep cutting humor, and very supportive of his students. He mentored me for a few years thereafter and was always happy to help lend an ear. But he was exceptionally smart and an exceptionally gifted communicator. And it was truly one of the transformational relationships of my life to have had the ability to learn tax from Marty Ginsburg. I feel blessed to have had that opportunity.
You mentioned his communication skills. It sounds like he was a model for you and maybe other students in that regard, because often tax lawyers are thought of as technicians. But of course, you have clients both within your firms and the client who's ultimately paying the bill, whom you have to communicate with.
Right. One of the skill sets of an effective tax lawyer is to take something that is very dense and very complicated and somewhat often counterintuitive, because the writers of the tax laws are not necessarily writing intuitive laws. They're trying to raise revenue. And so trying to distill that into something that a client can understand or a student can understand in a way that is digestible and ultimately actionable. So yeah, I think that's fair, David, to say that the more effective tax lawyers, and certainly Marty had this in spades, could couple a deep technical analytical knowledge, the ability to come up with creative solutions and find the answers to the problems, with the ability to break it down for a client or a student in a way that's commercial and actionable.
So talk about your move into the tax practice at Davis Polk and then how you developed as an associate.
So I had to actually really advocate on my behalf to be a tax lawyer. My mentor, Avishai Shachar, within the firm, who was running the group at the time, initially declined my request to join the department, which is a little bit of Davis Polk lore. But over some period of time, I continued to embrace it. I had amazing partner mentors here. I really loved the practice. As I said, I loved the fact that I could work on an M&A transaction, capital markets transaction, a bankruptcy, a litigation, take the tax discipline and apply it to that. But as I reflect upon one of the skill sets I think I bring to bear now as the firm's managing partner, it's the fact that as a tax lawyer, I actually saw a tremendous amount of the firm's operations. So while one thinks about tax as a fairly narrow gauge discipline, the reality is that you see a lot from a tax practice. And I think that has been very helpful to me in forming some foundational perspectives around our firm in my capacity as managing partner. But circling back to your question, over some period of time, I guess it became clear that I was a little bit good at it. And so I was getting opportunities on increasingly challenging and important transactions. I think it's fair to say I became partner on the back of my work on behalf of Comcast, who was then and still is one of our firm's largest and most important clients. At that time, the cable industry was very much intertwined. Comcast had interests in other cable companies. Other cable companies had interests in Comcast and a number of joint ventures. And over that, the period of the late 90s, really all the way through about 2008, 2009, the industry was consolidating and the interlocking ownerships were getting untangled. And those were very much tax-driven, or at least tax-structured. So Comcast, Time Warner, Adelphia did a big transaction. Comcast had a relationship with Liberty Media. I got involved with a number of the regional sports network deals that they were doing at the time and was viewed by the time I'd been promoted partner as a core part of the Comcast coverage team. And so that sort of is my journey, David, from the beginning of the practice, at least to making partner.
And then talk about the opportunity in the Comcast relationship to develop client skills, because obviously your expertise as a tax lawyer was really central to the work your firm was doing for Comcast.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think that they are and were a great client. They very much care about the type of work that I was doing. And the type of work that I was doing then was really foundational to the ability to execute the transactions they wanted to execute. When you work that much with a client, the nature of the personal relationships that you develop are very meaningful, both personally and professionally. And they were gracious and very supportive of me through the arc of my career in terms of pressing me on transactions, calling me with questions and new matters up and down the organization. And I think that was just a very important aspect of my personal career development. And I will always owe a debt of gratitude to Comcast. And for that reason, because I am and because I can be, I am also a loyal Comcast customer.
So after you made partner, talk about your career path as a manager, how you became involved in law firm management, what you enjoyed about it, and how you thought you added value as a manager.
So first few years as a partner, I was learning how to be a partner, and there wasn't a whole lot around active management, if you will, in my portfolio, which is appropriate for a junior. But I've always found the business of this business really interesting. I've always been intellectually stimulated by it. And so I was asked by my predecessor, Tom Reed, who was the managing partner at the time, to join our firm's compensation committee. I think it was in 2011. So I was probably a third or fourth year partner at the time. The compensation committee, as the name might imply, is the body within our organization that determines the compensation of partners and provides them with their performance reviews. So it was a really interesting opportunity for a very junior person to see the inner workings of the firm, what individual partners did, parts of the firm that I was not conversant with, I was responsible for understanding and providing review perspectives around. So that was just a wonderful opportunity that I was able to participate in that. I imagine I acquitted myself well because they didn't ask me to go away or anything. And indeed, after that all concluded, I think in about 2014, I was asked to become the head of the tax department. So it was really that initial arc of going from the compensation committee to becoming, at the time, one of the co-heads of the tax department with Abhishek. That was really the beginning of my foray into firm management.
So what is running a department in a law firm entail?
You know, I only had one job, which is to work at Davis Polk. So I can only express it in terms of what it meant then and means now at Davis Polk. And frankly, what it means now, probably even a little bit different from what it meant then. But if you think about a law firm department, it's a group of partners and a group of associates and the balance of the community that sits around that, from the administrative assistants, the legal assistants, and the like. And, you know, you're essentially running a business unit. You're responsible for a P&L. You're responsible for motivating and guiding and helping to shepherd the careers of all of those people, not just the partners, but the associates, and trying to be an empathetic and supportive leader in that context. Being commercially minded, thinking about a strategy for the group, thinking about financial objectives for the group. And I would say, as much as that was true in 2014, it's even more so now. This business of law has increasingly become the business of law. And so in today's world, you know, we very much rely on our group heads to really be business unit leaders and be accountable for all of that and for P&L outcomes as part of their job.
And so it sounds like you really enjoyed that aspect of being a partner.
I do. I very much enjoy engaging with people. I think I am extroverted by nature, and I really have a lot of fun professionally helping people achieve their goals, motivate them, think about their careers in a way that might be a little bit different, going out and talking to clients. I just really love the people aspect of this business. And so from a leadership perspective, it really does align with where I find a lot of professional satisfaction. Even so much so that even today, in my role as firm chair, I have a number of mentees in college and law school whom I'll do half-hour Zooms with all the time to just talk about their arcs, their career arcs, whether they want to go to law school. I just very much enjoy the part of this job that allows me to help other people accomplish what they want to accomplish.
And then talk about your transition to becoming chair and managing partner, which was a role you assumed in 2019.
Yeah, I mean, it would be disingenuous to say that I had not ever thought about potentially considering the job that I currently have, but it had come as a surprise to me. Tom Reed, unsurprisingly, was destined to bigger and better things and came and told the partners that he was going to be leaving the firm to become the general counsel and chief legal officer at Comcast. Again, thematically here, Comcast plays a role in all of the stories here at Davis Polk. And so the firm at that point elected me to be the managing partner, and off we went.
How did you feel prepared to take on that role at that point? And what elements of the job did you feel like you were maybe less than totally ready to take on, even though you had to take them on?
It's a very interesting question, because this industry does not do a great job in terms of leadership development. And so while I definitely had a number of opportunities to hone my leadership skills through the years before becoming managing partner, and you know, I had opportunity to spend a lot of time with a lot of different parts of the firm, both in my tax practice as well as in my capacity as a member of the comp committee, I'm not sure that I knew at that time what I was equipped to do and what I was not equipped to do, other than I intimately knew the organization. I was confident around that. I had some impressions about the strategic direction that I thought that the organization needed to go. But I think, David, for the first year or so, I think I was kind of just learning on the job. And so from a succession planning perspective, I was kind of doing it real time during 2019. I would like to think I have not stopped learning and that I'm learning every day, but very much, I would say my first year as the chair of the firm was a learn on the job, every day something new type of exercise.
What were the most important things you learned in that first year?
The most important thing I learned was a confirmation of an instinct that I had had, which is while a law firm leader is ultimately responsible for the outcome of the organization, in the context of a human capital business, consensus building is an exceedingly important part of the job. And that making sure that I was communicating with my partners as to the reasons that we were taking the steps that we were taking, providing them information that was data-driven and that was ultimately supportive of the proposition was a really important part of the job. And to effectuate change in an organization like this, it was really important to get buy-in.
That's your first year. And then your second year, maybe your third year and your fourth year was COVID.
Yes. So if you think about what I just said, my first year on the job, I was elected to be the firm's managing partner in, I think it was mid-March 2019. If it was April, it was April by a couple of days. And I was learning on the job, if you will, as I just said, for a year. You know, think about when the world went remote. I think the date was March 13th, 2020, something like that, was the last Friday in the office or the first Monday out, I can't recall. That's about a year after I had become the chair. So we were just kind of getting started, if you will. We had just had our first annual partners meeting that I conducted. And then the next thing you know, we were out of the office for the next year and a half, 2 years. It's certainly not how you would draw it up.
On the other hand, by that point, you had been at Davis Polk for almost 20 years. So you obviously had a very deep knowledge of the institution. So talk about the importance of knowledge of a firm versus knowledge of the legal industry in your running Davis Polk or any institution. How many of these challenges are firm specific? And how many of them are issues that all of your peer firms face?
Well, I think with COVID, it was a little bit of both, just to take an example, and maybe we could telescope out from there. But I knew that it was very important to me to communicate to our firm that we were going to take care of our people during COVID. And I knew that that was an important thing to say early and without qualification. And so we actually convened, I think during that first week, it was an all-firm town hall where I told people that we're going to play this out as the long game, that Davis Polk is an institution that is going to support its people, that our objective was to keep everyone employed through COVID. And obviously, things turned around very fast after all of this, so we didn't have the benefit of hindsight at the time. But I think it was important to our institutional value system that everyone in our organization felt as safe as they could on things that at least we could control. And so ultimately, our folks in the cafeteria, we paid them even when they didn't work and the firm was closed. We took a number of actions that I think, knowing my organization, it was really important to maintain our value system through that period of time. I'm sure other organizations do that. I'm sure we were not unique in that regard. But something like that is very much, I think, Davis Polk. You know, if you move forward, when you move out of that type of crisis proposition and you go to a more business as usual environment, I think it's very hard to say in the context of 2025 business that you can extract a Davis Polk issue from a legal industry issue. The industry is now so dynamic and we're all competing so aggressively that everything that's an industry issue is a Davis Polk issue. And at some level, most Davis Polk issues tend to touch the industry as well.
What issues do you focus on most in your job?
It's interesting. So within my practice, which is very important to me, my practice has fully changed. I actually am no longer a practicing tax lawyer. I've taken a number of the skill sets and opportunities that I've had over the last 6 years to advise strategic clients on their most significant matters as a more generalist corporate advisor. And in the context of my professional practice and my client-facing role, that's a bucket of issues that I am always focused on. Clients are always first. And I've found it to be a tremendously rewarding professional development that I've been able to evolve into a second phase of my practice that is very much aligned with my role as the firm's managing partner. It works well in that way. But I think your question, David, may have been more around the inward-facing management of the law firm industry. And there are a handful. How partners are compensated is a very important part of the job. It's a very important part of the competitive dynamic at the moment. It feeds into a second issue, which is the importance in this environment of retaining the best talent and recruiting the best talent. And here I'm focused in the first instance on partners and lateral partner movements, but also on associates and counsel as well. Making sure that our practices are appropriately sized for the right market opportunity. So making sure that the scale and positioning of a particular practice or practice group is sensible in relation to the market opportunity as we want to imagine it. What the cultural fabric of this place is, as we pride ourselves on being a team-oriented, firm-first, client outcomes are most important type of law firm. We think our brand is very much enhanced by the fact that we have absolutely exceptional lawyers here who consistently deliver great outcomes for our clients. And making sure that the client being first and the client's outcome being first is not lost in this increasingly competitive shuffle that is the law firm business is an important part of that. And part of making sure that the client outcome is the best possible client outcome is creating an internal culture that gets the best team focused on the client's issues with the least friction possible. And so I spend a lot of time around our firm culture of cohesiveness and collaboration and team orientation, principally because I want to make sure our clients get to the right place. And secondarily, because I think the nature of the culture that we have here at Davis Polk is part of the glue of the institution. And I think our partners, and indeed I hope our associates as well, derive their own form of professional satisfaction from the fact that we think this is a good place to work.
As a young partner, you served on your firm's compensation committee. Talk about the evolution in maybe your law firm's thinking about compensation, but certainly how that's evolved in the industry and the relation or the tension between that evolution and issues around retention of your key people.
Maybe to start, I'll spend a minute on just our compensation evolution. So from when I became a partner many years before that until 2020, Davis Polk was a pure lockstep compensation firm. For those who aren't familiar with what that means that the least senior partner makes the least, and then there's a seniority progression up such that the most senior partners in the firm make the most. That was a model that dated back to a time when the highest contributing partners were generally the more senior partners, and that there was an alignment between sort of seniority and contribution. And by 2020, that was no longer true. And not only was that no longer true, it was also an impediment to growing the firm because you could not make promotion or hiring decisions without a decision that the partner would be worthy of the highest, most compensation. So against that backdrop, we concluded that we needed to modify our compensation system. We spent a lot of time thinking about what made the most sense for us. We actually decided we were going to change, but we did not immediately decide what we were going to change into. We actually took a step back and began looking at who we are, who we were at that time, and who we wanted to be. And we spent about 2 months articulating our firm's value system. What is it about Davis Polk that we think is special? So that we could then build the compensation structure that would leverage those things that we thought were special and where we're sort of responsive to who we wanted to be. So things like a single firm, things like excellence of lawyering mattering, things like selflessness, things like alignment within the partnership. We articulated those as core values of our institution during that period of time. And then from there, we developed a compensation structure that works for our firm, which is responsive to those goals and that value system. Now, why do we have to do that? And why begin to sense of all forward? It's just undeniable that talent in this market is much more mobile than it ever has been. And that's both an opportunity for a firm like ours, as well as a threat. We've been quite fortunate on the threat side to be able to retain most of our people. But there is a reality to that, which is that increasingly legal talent is mobile. And you can just see it statistically in numbers that partners move among firms much more than they have before. And so having a flexible, performance-oriented compensation model that rewards performance and that can allow us to go into a market for lateral talent and provide a compensation structure that aligns with lateral partners' objectives and needs, that was very important for us. And so we've been mindful of that really since 2020. And I've said publicly before that we are restructuring our system even further now. I'm not going to go into the details of the restructuring, but to be more responsive to where the market is and to recognize the market realities.
And it's interesting, there's a tension. And again, not just at your firm, but I think very broadly, for many, even very senior lawyers, their relationships with their other partners at their firm are an integral part of the satisfaction they get out of the practice. And there is a tension between a much more robust market in lateral talent and the reality that, again, for many lawyers of all seniority levels, one of the key things that makes the job fun is the people they work with. And so I think every firm has to wrestle with how to strike that balance.
So I agree with that. And I think it would be to deny reality to say that's not true. But I think there's a big difference between saying there's a tension, which I agree with, and saying that those two propositions are not compatible. We think with the right set of incentives, the right structure of a compensation system, the right performance evaluations, and the cohesiveness of the partnership, that we can walk a path here where we can both address the market facing issues while continuing to provide a culture of this firm that's professionally satisfying for not just the partners, but for the associates, the counsel, the very high performing folks in our business services function who support what we do. So I fully agree with the proposition that not attended to, there's a deep tension. But I think with the right care and feeding, firms, at least like ours, and I'm sure others too, can walk a path by which they can be very competitive in the market and still maintain this inward focus of institutional mindset.
As you look out over the next, say, 5 years, what do you see as the most critical issues facing your firm and peer firms?
So I think we will have a bucket of issues that are inherent to the legal industry along the lines of what I just mentioned, whether it's lateral partners, there's the concept of the non-equity tier of partners, how big law firms need to be to remain competitive, what the sort of appropriate scale is. So I think there's the universe of those issues, which, David, I'm sure many people on your podcast talk about them. They're very reasonably well covered in the legal press. I think there's a set of issues that are what I might think of as more geopolitical or macro. We have, for example, the zero interest rate policy of the prior decade is clearly no longer here, and we're in a more inflationary environment, and thinking about how interest rate environment along the lines of what we had, what that will imply for business is important. We've got a number of geopolitical issues, including what appears to be maybe deglobalization on the horizon. You know, I think a number of our law firms, the international global law firms, were sort of built with a mindset of globalization and are supporting those type of trade flows. And so those trade flows diminish or go away. Law firms like ours will have to think about what the right coverage models will be to still maintain a global presence. But we'll just have to think about those type of things. And then I think the third bucket would be technological in nature. So most commonly discussed, and I think fairly so, is this evolution of generative AI, which will likely have some implications on our business as well. So I would think those would be the buckets without going into a deep dive into what I think about each of those.
And finally, Neil, talk about what you do to decompress from the job.
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, I like to spend time with my family. I like to lift weights. I run. I spend time with my friends. just the stuff that people do when they're not working to find a little bit of R&R, make sure you get your exercise and get your head into a good space. So that's all I do.
Neil, thank you so much for joining us today.
David, thank you very much for having me.
For Drinks with a Deal, I'm David Marcus.